Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier. It's Friday, June 25th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. The Courier is forecasting a mostly cloudy and humid day today. Winds from the north at 6 to 12 miles per hour. We'll have a high of 85 degrees. Tonight it will go down to 68 degrees, and you can expect heavy rain and a thunderstorm. Winds this time from the east, 6 to 12 miles per hour. As we look around the region today, mostly cloudy and humid. Some rain and thunderstorm early tonight, then heavy rain and a thunderstorm. A thunderstorm tomorrow. Sunday, times of clouds and sun. We have a full moon now, and it's waning. The next phase will be last quarter on July 1st. The sun rose this morning at 5:33 a.m., and it will set tonight at 8:51 p.m. The days are getting shorter now. We have four stories on the front page, and they include Tyson attorneys seek to move COVID lawsuit to federal court. UNI eyes 1.5% tuition hike. A mayor memorialized. And we begin with Reynolds will send troops to border. The story is filed by Rob Bossart and begins with a photograph of the governor as she's speaking to reporters. Des Moines. Up to 30 Iowa State Patrol officers will be redeployed for about 2 weeks to the U.S.-Mexico border to help law enforcement efforts there, Governor Kim Reynolds announced Thursday. Reynolds said she approved the action in response to requests from Republican governors Greg Abbott of Texas and Doug Ducey of Arizona. Quote, "My first responsibility is to the health and safety of Iowans, and the humanitarian crisis at our nation's southern border is affecting all 50 states," Reynolds said in a statement. Quote, "The rise in drugs, human trafficking, and violent crime have become unsustainable. Iowa has no choice but to act," unquote. The governor said the Iowa Department of Public Safety assured her the move will not compromise service in Iowa. But it comes after state patrol officials warned earlier this month that traffic fatalities were spiking on Iowa roadways due to increasingly dangerous driving and vowed that they would step up enforcement. The state has also recently agreed to help Davenport fight a rise in gun violence. The year has also seen the first trooper shot and killed in the line of duty in decades. An exhaustive search for a missing boy that remains ongoing, an attack in which inmates killed two prison workers, and a shooting that wounded a Linn County deputy. Iowa joins Florida, Nebraska, and Idaho, states all led by Republican governors, in sending law enforcement to the border. Currently, the Iowa State Patrol has 360 sworn staff, with 267 solely assigned to road duty, according to the IDPS. A department email obtained by WHO-TV said the state, quote, "will be soliciting officers to travel to Texas to support this request. We anticipate the travel dates will be July 8th through the 23rd, 2021, unquote. Under an interstate pact, the states requesting the aid must reimburse states that provide it. In a news release, Reynolds' office said the Iowa National Guard currently is conducting a mission with 24 soldiers to assist law enforcement agencies at the southern border, per an October 2020 request from the federal government. In May, there were roughly 180,000 border encounters, a 20-year high, according to the governor's office. Also, U.S. Customs and Border Protection in March reported a 233% increase in fentanyl seizures from the previous year. In May, that year-over-year increase climbed to 300%. Manny Galvez, a North Liberty resident and Catholic Worker House activist, said Reynolds should be welcoming immigrants to Iowa, not sending state police to the border. Quote, "This is crazy. The governor denied welcoming children, and now she's sending the police. How shameful and absolutely irrational waste of state resources," Galvez said in a statement. a spokesman for Iowa City Catholic Worker, said the organization has helped admit 10 refugee families into the country since January 20th, after they were initially expelled back to Mexico under a federal order. The group has 18 cases pending with the American Civil Liberties Union, and its members also have helped 4 families reunite with unaccompanied family members this year. Reynolds made her deployment announcement on the eve of Vice President Kamala Harris' planned trip to the U.S.-Mexico border in El Paso, Texas. The Harris visit follows weeks of criticism that she hasn't visited the area despite being tasked by the Biden administration with trying to alleviate the flow of migration over the southern border. Conservatives have been pushing Harris to visit the border for weeks as they raise alarm over a record number of unaccompanied children who have crossed into the United States this spring. Former President Donald Trump plans on touring Texas's southern border next week with Abbott, who recently announced that Texas will take steps to build its own border wall and has touted Operation Lone Star, an initiative to bolster state law enforcement presence at the border. Reynolds previously criticized Biden administration officials' lack of transparency in flying 19 refugee children into Des Moines to be transported to sponsor families without notifying her or other Iowa officials. The action occurred, she said, despite her previous rejection of a federal request that immigrant children be housed in Iowa. Our next story is filed by Jeff Reinitz, and it's titled, Tyson Attorneys Seek to Move COVID Lawsuit to Federal Court. Waterloo. A lawsuit brought by relatives of 2 Tyson workers in Waterloo and Independence who died days apart of COVID-19 has been transferred to federal court. It's a move that hasn't worked for other coronavirus lawsuits against the meatpacking giant. Family members of Jeffrey Orvis and Arthur Scott, both of Waterloo, filed suit against Tyson Fresh Meats, Tyson Pet Products, and a list of plant officials and supervisors in Black Hawk County District Court in April, alleging the company ignored warnings about the coronavirus pandemic and didn't take the necessary steps to protect workers. On Monday, the suit was transferred to U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids at the request of the defense, claiming the allegations involve actions the company took at the direction of federal officers, former President Donald Trump, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and the Department of Agriculture. Orvis, 65, worked at the Waterloo plant and died April 19, 2020. Scott, 51, was employed at the Independence facility and died April 23, 2020. Their deaths came as community leaders and health officials were calling for Tyson to close the Waterloo operation amid a COVID-19 outbreak, a call the company dismissed for more than a week before shuttering the operation on May 22, 2020. In court records, Tyson denied the allegations, saying it invested millions in safety equipment and followed federal workplace guidelines. Quote, Tyson worked hand in hand with federal officials from the time of the declaration of a national emergency on March 13th to safely continue operations to aid the federal government in accomplishing its duty to secure the national food supply, the company's attorney said in a court record. Attorneys for the plaintiffs pointed out that Tyson had processed enough meat to increase its exports to China during the pandemic, and they noted the Independence plant, where Scott worked, doesn't make food, it makes dog treats. Quote, although Tyson's plant manufactures dog treats, Tyson claimed it was critical infrastructure and essential to the nation's food supply, the suit states. The Independence plant remained open after the governor issued an order closing non-essential businesses March 26, 2020. Quote, perhaps sensing the tenuous nature of its claim that manufacturing dog treats was essential, employees were given a letter to carry with them indicating that their work was essential, the suit states. Trial dates haven't been set, and it isn't clear if the suit will remain in federal court. Similar suits against Tyson Foods, filed by the families of deceased workers Sadika Buljic, Reburano Garcia, Jose Ayala, and Isidio Fernandez, had also been diverted to the federal court on similar grounds at the company's request. A U.S. district court judge disagreed with the claim the company was, quote, acting on the direction of federal officers as reason for the transfer, and sent the cases back to Black Hawk County District Court in December. That decision is being challenged in the United States Courts of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, which has put the cases on pause. In this story filed by Andrew Wind, University of Northern Iowa proposes 1.5% increase in tuition for 2021-22. Cedar Falls. Tuition would grow by 1.5% next fall at the University of Northern Iowa under a proposal discussed Thursday by the Board of Regents during a virtual meeting. Undergraduate students who are residents of Iowa taking 12 or more credit hours would pay $7,780 in tuition for 2021-22, a $115 increase. Resident undergraduate tuition would grow by 3.5% at both Iowa and Iowa State universities. Although tuition rates are different for UNI's resident and non-resident students, as well as at the graduate level, all would see the same percentage increase. Tuition would rise $137 for resident graduate students to $9,296. With non-resident students, tuition would grow by $273 for undergraduates to $18,480 and by $295 for graduate students to $19,928. Northern Iowa proposed no increase in its mandatory student fees, which would total $1,273 during the next year for all students taking 12 or more credit hours per semester. The estimated cost of attendance, which also includes room and board, books and supplies, transportation, and other living expenses, is $21,409 at UNI. Room and board rates are set at $9,160, the same as for the past year. The tuition and fee rates will return to the region's July 28 meeting for a vote. Alisanne Strzok, Northern Iowa Student Government Vice President, cautioned the board to minimize any increase it approves. Quote, UNI has a goal of keeping tuition affordable for our students, she said. Quote, while we understand that tuition must go up to ensure quality, we are concerned about the long-term impact on our students, unquote. Strzok urged the board to support a request to the legislature for $4 million in new money for UNI during the next fiscal year. She said those funds are intended to keep tuition rates flat, helping to maintain access and affordability. The board has made the same request for the current year, but the state funding for all three universities was frozen by the legislature. Other student government representatives sounded similar themes. Quote, an increase in tuition is something students are never excited to hear, said Reagan Smock, student body president for University of Iowa undergraduates, calling for an approach that is sustainable and affordable. Quote, we need systemic changes in our funding model, she added. The burden should not be placed squarely on the shoulders of young people, unquote. She highlighted some of the ways each region's university affected the state. Smock noted that during the fiscal year 2018, UNI's economic impact supported 22,000 jobs, or one out of every 94 in Iowa. Our state should be proud to invest in these entities, she said, suggesting that underfunding sends future doctors, lawyers, and engineers to other states. Julia Campbell, president of Iowa State University's undergraduate student government, discussed the, quote, tremendous value of college education and the tangible benefits it offers, including lower unemployment, more tax revenues, and fewer demands on government services. Following a year of pandemic-related challenges, she said, quote, We're asking that it be as small of an increase as possible, while still maintaining exceptional educational quality. Walt Wang, Vice President of Graduate and Professional Education at the University of Iowa, called for a refocusing of our priorities in the state, citing the decline in state support for higher education during the past two decades. He said an affordable education is no longer considered a necessity by the state, unquote. Regents President Michael Richards said tuition and fee rates for the coming year have been looked at very closely by the board. The regents really do try to keep the cost to the students as low as we can and keep the quality up there, he said. Quote, I appreciate everyone's honest and straightforward discussion today, unquote. Iowa and Iowa State universities are also proposing to increase mandatory student fees for next year. At Iowa, they would go up $53.50 for full-time undergraduates and $46.50 for graduate students. At Iowa State, they would go up $36 for all full-time students. Undergraduate tuition and fees at the University of Iowa would total $9,942 for resident students and $31,905 for non-residents, an increase of $336.50 for each. Graduate tuition and fees would be $12,065 and $31,012 for resident and non-resident students, respectively, a $399.50 increase. The estimated cost of attendance at Iowa would be $25,534, a $1,080 increase. Tuition and fees for undergraduates at Iowa State University would total $9,633.90 for residents, a $318 increase, and $25,445.90 for non-residents, a $942 increase. For graduate students, the cost would total $11,403.90 for residents, a $418 increase, and $26,947.90 for non-residents, a $1,000 increase. The estimated cost of attendance at Iowa State would be $21,192.90, a $213 increase. Both Iowa and ISU have also requested differential tuition rates for certain higher-cost undergraduate and graduate programs. Melody Parker filed this next story. Monumental steel sculpture pays tribute to former Cedar Falls mayor. And it begins with a head-and-shoulders photograph of Gillian Christie. Cedar Falls. Everyone hopes to make a mark, make a difference in people's lives, and leave behind a legacy. The late mayor, John Cruz, accomplished that. On Thursday, Cedar Falls residents paid tribute to his memory at the dedication of a new public artwork in his honor. Fence Roadway, designed by award-winning Boston artist and University of Northern Iowa graduate Gillian Christie, was installed and dedicated. And here we have a photograph of two women and two men and a photographer unloading the sculpture from the back of a van truck and onto a forklift. The stainless steel and powder-coated steel sculpture measures 9 feet 5 inches tall by 8 feet wide and 4 feet deep. It was installed Thursday morning outside Cedar Falls City Hall on Clay Street, where the Eternal Flame sculpture previously stood. That sculpture has been moved to Veterans Park. Cruz's family and friends, as well as Christie, were present for the unveiling at a ceremony Thursday evening. And now we have a photograph of people preparing that sculpture. One woman is standing on a ladder wearing a hard hat, and another looks on. Cruz served 3 stints as mayor, totaling more than 30 years. He was one of the youngest mayors in the country when first elected in 1971, at age 24. He served until 1979, and again from 1987 to 1993, and 1999 to 2015. He died in April 2017 after battling liver cancer. And here is another photograph of the forklift and workers assembling the structure. The new commemorative structure, at the behest of Cruz's brother Chuck of Columbia, Missouri, and Cruz's wife, Ronelle Langley, is meant to focus on Cruz's devotion to the community. The Cedar Falls Public Art Committee began an 18-month process in 2018 for planning, fundraising, requesting applications, and selecting an artist for the commission. Dan Perry, UNI instructor and coordinator of the Public Art Incubator, worked on raising the $20,000 for the sculpture and installation. Quote, John was such a strong supporter of the arts, and the Public Art Committee really flourished under his administration to where it is now. So this seems very fitting. Jillian's sculpture is a representation of building a community and growing ideas. It's not a straightforward memorial piece. It's open to interpretation, Perry said. Originally, the sculpture was planned for installation last summer, but the coronavirus pandemic delayed the event. Christy, a Davenport native, graduated from UNI in 2002. Quote, I enjoy making artwork that serves as a celebration of something, designing and creating work that is positive and uplifting, Christy said. Quote, I was in the beginning stage of making this piece, and the fact that it was honoring the mayor and his community spirit, it seemed to work. I'm glad the committee liked it and thought it would be fitting, unquote. Christy typically works within the notion that connectors, those things in our built environment like roads and fences, connect us to each other. I've always liked the cobblestone, quote, follow the yellow brick road theme, wrapping it into a dynamic sculpture. She credits Tom Stancliffe, a UNI professor emeritus in art, with opening her eyes to creating public art. Quote, I always imagined myself as being a sculptor with clay. Then I took a class with him and learned to weld with metal. I liked that I could weld something and build a piece of art that could stand up by itself and not break. I could see Tom actively working on his own public art projects, and I began imagining that for myself, she explained. Christy recently received a Mass Mutual Council Fellowship and has received grants from New England Foundation for the Arts, Rhode Island State Council for the Arts, and the Rhode Island Foundation. She is a past recipient of the Americans for the Arts, America's Best Reviewed Public Art Award. Commercially, she has created artwork for NFL on CBS, among others, and for the W Hotel in Boston. Turning the page now to the Cedar Valley section, we have the fifth in a series on this year's 8 over 80 winners. Stan and Bev McAdam are a Cedar Valley volunteer duo, Waterloo. Stan and Bev McAdam have packed quite a 1-2 punch of volunteerism in their entire 44 years in the Cedar Valley, both individually and as a team. The natives of New York State have been active in serving the Church Row neighborhood through First United Methodist Church and in their individual endeavors. Stan, who worked for years as an executive at the Mead Corporation Weyerhaeuser facility in Waterloo, mentored young people at Irving Elementary School through the Local Partners in Education program and received a Governor's Volunteer Award in 2010. He also volunteered and helped design a landscaping labyrinth at the Cedar Valley Arboretum and Botanical Gardens and worked with the retired Senior Volunteer Program. Stan also volunteered with Junior Achievement as an instructor. Bev has been active with the Alzheimer's Association with a personal interest since her mother had suffered from the condition. For the past 20 years, she has worked as a trained volunteer counselor with the Senior Health Insurance Information Program, or SHIIP, SHIP, counseling senior citizens on finding the best Medicare supplement insurance plans. Bev, like Stan, also is a past recipient of the Governor's Volunteer Award. Volunteerism was a learned trait. Quote, as I was growing up, My mother did a lot of volunteer work, Bev said, and so I kind of saw her involvement in the community in my early years. And as I look back, I thought, well, she really did kind of pave the way for me to do it. And when her mother developed Alzheimer's, quote, that took me in the direction of volunteer work, she said, inspired by Kathy Martin, an administrator at Friendship Village. Quote, I didn't know all things about that disease that I know now. I vowed to help others so they didn't make the same mistakes. So I was involved with the Alzheimer's Association, was on their board, did fundraising, and the big thing I did was to lead a support group, and I led that for 20 years, unquote. That parallels her involvement with the SHIP program. Quote, I really enjoy the people, the clients. Some of them I've had for years, and I miss them when something happens to them. So I've enjoyed that, and that's a great one for keeping your mind active. It was a lot easier for me because of the training they give you. I feel an obligation to my clients. They are a little frantic sometimes as to what to do. So it's a great organization. Bev was previously employed at Aerial Services Incorporated in Cedar Falls for 12 years. The interest in the Arboretum was a labor of love. We both loved gardening. We just enjoyed it, she said. Stan helped design the landscaping labyrinth with friend Manly Orum, which earned them both recognition in a 2009 issue of the Iowan magazine. Stan also helped with pruning and landscaping maintenance at the Arboretum and helped paint its visitor center. While each had their own areas of interest, both were jointly involved at their church, said Ellen Vanderloo, who nominated the McAdams for 8-over-8 recognition. Quote, they helped organize Wednesday night neighborhood meals, Vanderloo noted. Bev has been diligent in her efforts to reach out to shut-ins through home visits and recently by sending notes of encouragement and treat bags, unquote. The coronavirus pandemic presented challenges for volunteers as well as those they serve. Stan is resuming Meals on Wheels volunteer work this month. Bev has had to do much of her SHIP work by Zoom teleconference from home, but has made it work. Quote, it's nice to pay back, you know, Bev said. We've been fortunate in this community. It's nice to share our time with the community. Stan's the kind of person that when someone raises a need, when something comes up, he just steps forward and says, well, I've got time, I can do that. That happens a lot with him, unquote. Quote, in the 44 years we have lived in the Cedar Valley, Stan and Bev McAdam have quietly been impacting the lives of its residents, Vanderloo wrote. They have had a volunteer mindset from their early years when they served as Brownie and Eagle Scout leaders all the way up to their retirement, unquote. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Friday, June 25th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Marietta Muchow passed away in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, on October 6, 2020, due to complications of COVID-19. Marietta was born in Frankville, Iowa, to Walter and Esther, maiden name Hangartner, Van Way, on November 19, 1933, the second of five Van Way children. Marietta attended Frankville Village School and Postville Community School. On August 12, 1951, Marietta married Keith Sandler Muchow at the Little Brown Church in Nashua, Iowa. Marietta and Keith had five children, Connie, Carolyn, James, Lisa, and Scott. Marietta and Keith lived briefly in the Postville, Waukon area before moving to Waterloo, Iowa, where they resided for 20-plus years. Keith's career as a commercial pilot led them to live in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, and Texas, before moving to Forest City, Clear Lake, Iowa, where they both worked for Winnebago Industries. Sadly, soon after both had retired, Keith passed away from cancer on January 13, 2008. Marietta stayed in Clear Lake until failing health kept her from living alone. She then lived with her son, Jim, in Broken Arrow for several years, and then lived with her daughter Lisa in Coweta, Oklahoma, for her last few years. The family is planning a memorial service at the Postville Cemetery on September 5th at 1:30 p.m. Donna Marie Wilworth Mitchell, beloved wife, sister, mother, and good friend, died peacefully at Prairie Hills Assisted Living, Independence, Iowa, on June 17, 2021, at the age of 63. Donna was born June 27, 1957, to Donald and Catherine Damish Wilmerth in Waterloo, Iowa. She graduated from Wapsie Valley High School in 1975. She continued her education at Hawkeye Community College in Waterloo, becoming a nurse's aide, continuing on to LPN, then a registered nurse, and ultimately receiving her Bachelor of Science degree in Health Arts at St. Francis College in Chicago, Illinois. Donna married Earl Mitchell of New Albion, Iowa, in 2002. Donna enjoyed traveling, camping, and working with Earl, helping others in spiritual direction. She taught nurse's aide courses at Kirkwood Community College, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, worked as a nurse in home health and nursing homes, and authored various articles and books. Visitation will be from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock p.m. on June 28, 2021, at St. Mary's Catholic Church, Manchester, Iowa, with celebration of life following at 3 o'clock p.m. A private burial will be at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Northwest Iowa Food Bank. Rhinebeck. Vernon Conradi, 93, of Rhinebeck, passed away on Wednesday, June 23, 2021, at Parkview Manor in Rhinebeck. Per Vernon's request, there will be no services. He has donated his body to the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine for research and the education of our future doctors and nurses. Vernon was born May 14, 1928, in Grundy County, the son of Neil and Tina Conradi. He attended country school through the eighth grade, then Grundy Center High School. He was a strong man and would try to fix anything. He kept his good-natured mind and smiles through the last few months of his journey. Vernon grew up a farm boy and never lost that interest. He worked at Rath Packing and then lived in Colorado until moving back to Rhinebeck in 2014. He married Lois Gibson in 1950 and then served in the Army as a medical aide at Fort Carson, Colorado during the Korean conflict. Vernon is survived by his wife, Lois Conradi, sister Lois Knack, sisters-in-law Nancy Juggling, and artist Conradi, and many special nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, brothers Merle and Melvin, and an infant brother. Ryan Roy Cooper was born June 1, 1979, in Waterloo, the son of Jan and Connie, maiden name Beck, Cooper. He graduated from North Tama High School in 1998. After high school, he pursued his passion for farming and joined the family farm. Ryan was well known for being a hard-working farmer, truck driver, and cattle producer. He was proud to be continuing the Cooper farming legacy. His love for his family was even greater than his passion for farming. Ryan and his first wife were blessed with his oldest son, Cole Roy. Later, Ryan married Karina Alpers at Zion Lutheran Church in Dysart. Together, they have three beautiful children, Kayed A.H. Jr., Cable Ryan, Cortland Evan. Ryan was great with all children, and it was clear to everyone how much he adored his kids. Ryan liked cheering for the Iowa State Cyclones and tossing back cold Busch Lights with his friends. He tore it up on the snowmobile trails, treated his family to annual summer trips to Wisconsin, and never said no to jet ski and boat rides with his kids at the Lake of the Ozarks. Ryan was known for customizing and accessorizing everything with a motor and keeping them sparkling clean. His attention to detail was unmatched, from picking out landscaping to designing a custom shop for all his favorite fast toys and beer-drinking buddies. Ryan will forever be remembered with a phone clipped to his hip, a headset over his hat, rubber memory bracelets around his waist, and pant legs hanging over the top of his work boots. Ryan died on Friday, June 18, 2021, at the age of 42. Memorials may be directed to the Traer Fire Department or North Tama FFA. Visitation will be Sunday, June 27th, at the Zion Lutheran Church in Dysart from 4 to 7 p.m. Services will be Monday, June 28th, at the Zion Lutheran Church in Dysart at 10 o'clock a.m. Burial will be at the Crystal Cemetery. Overton Funeral Home is handling arrangements. Their phone number is 319-478-2775. Condolences may be left at www.overtonfuneralhomes.com. Cedar Falls. Eugene Gene F. Bright, 91, of Cedar Falls, died Tuesday, June 22, 2021, at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital in Waterloo. Services will be 10:30 a.m. Monday, June 28, 2021, at St. John Lutheran Church, with burial in Cedar Valley Memorial Gardens. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service time at the church. Memorials may be directed to the church or Christian Crusaders. Online condolences may be left at www.dahlfuneralhome.com. Holland. Patricia Ann Neeson, 73, of Holland, passed away on June 22, 2021, at Mercy One Medical Center in Waterloo, Iowa. A visitation will be held from 5 o'clock p.m. until 7 o'clock p.m. on Friday, June 25, 2021, at the Abel's Funeral and Cremation Service, Anglicus Chapel in Grundy Center. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, June 26, 2021, at the Colfax Center Presbyterian Church in rural Holland, Iowa. Burial will follow at Rose Hill Cemetery in Grundy Center, Iowa. Memorials may be directed to the family. Patricia Ann Neeson was born March 15, 1948, in Eldora, Iowa, daughter of Carl J. and Carrie, maiden name Murra, Niederhoff. She graduated from Wellsburg High School in 1965 and then attended Ellsworth Community College in Iowa Falls for 1 year. She was employed as a secretary for 5 years in the law firm of Klebenstein and Hieronymus in Grundy Center, and also served as a church organist for more than 50 years. On May 11, 1971, she married Luray Neeson in Wellsburg, Iowa. They raised their family on a farm by Wellsburg until they moved to Holland, Iowa in 2000. Patricia was a homemaker who enjoyed playing the piano, reading, baking, completing crossword puzzles, and doing counted cross-stitch projects. She especially enjoyed spending time with her grandchildren. Patricia was a member and organist for Colfax Center Presbyterian Church. She was a devoted wife, mother, and grandmother who will be remembered for her unending kindness, gentle love, and strong faith. Let's turn to the sports page now. Tigers stay red hot. In prep softball, Cedar Falls sweeps East, extend winning streak to 9. Story filed by Craig Sesker, the sports correspondent. Waterloo. If he hadn't witnessed it firsthand, he wouldn't have believed it. But Cedar Falls coach Steve Chidester has orchestrated one of the most remarkable turnarounds in the state this summer. The Tigers stumbled to a 10-game losing streak and dropped 11 of their first 12 softball games. But that's ancient history now. Red-hot Cedar Falls extended its winning streak to 9 straight after taking a hard-fought doubleheader from Waterloo East, 8-6 and 2-1, Thursday night at Trojan Field. The Tigers improved to 16-14 overall. They have won 15 of their last 18 games after that brutal start. Quote, "Even when we started slowly early in the season, our girls stuck with it and kept working hard," Chidester said. "We've got a good young team with players who are very coachable and who are eager to learn. It's finally paying off for them now. We've learned how to win, and it carried over into tonight." The Trojans dropped to 10-18 overall after the closely contested Mississippi Valley Conference matchup. Quote, "It was the same thing we've been doing all year," East coach Chad Adams said. "We out-hit people and we out-aired them, plain and simple. It's tough when you give a team those extra outs. And we've been getting good pitching. We're just not playing defense at the level we need to, and it's costing us wins," unquote. Cedar Falls relied on a superb pitching performance by freshman Kennedy Strelo and a clutch hit by senior Delfina Hillenthal to prevail in Game 2. Strelo, 2-0, went 7 strong innings, allowing just a single run in the second inning. She ran into trouble in the 7th as East loaded the bases, but kept her composure. Strelo capped her magical night by recording 2 7th-inning strikeouts, including one to end the game. Quote, "I knew I needed to hit my spots," Strelo said. "I trust my defense, and they did a great job behind me. It's really fun to be part of a team that's playing well like this. It felt really good to get that last strikeout. I was really excited." The Tigers scored the eventual game winner in a bizarre top of the 6th inning. With 2 outs and Lex Hess at second base, Cedar Falls brought in Lauren Sandvold to pitch hit for Hillenthal. Sandvold promptly ripped a double down the left field line to drive in Hess. But Adams protested because Sandvold had not been reported into the game as a pinch hitter, although her name was announced as she came to the plate. After a conference between the umpires and coaches, Hess was sent back to second base and Hillenthal was sent to the plate. Quote, "I take full responsibility for that," Chidester said. "I should have reported Sandvold when she came up to bat." Hillenthal fell behind in the count 0-2. Before delivering a sharp single to center field to drive in Hess. That RBI proved to be the difference. Quote, "I was caught off guard a little bit with everything going on," Hillenthal said. "I had faced that pitcher before, and I had some confidence going up there. It was really exciting to have a big hit like that. I don't think I've ever had one like that before. We're really playing well, and it's fun to be part of it," Chidester credited his senior. Quote, "Delfina didn't think she was going to bat, and then she's called up there to bat," Chidester said. "She doesn't have a lot of at-bats, but that was clutch. She's a senior, and I'm really proud of her," unquote. In the opener, the Tigers struck for 6 unearned runs as the Trojans committed 4 errors in a pivotal 3rd inning. East chipped away and closed to within 7-5 when Mason Brewis doubled and raced home on Jaden Bentley's RBI single in the 6th. Cedar Falls added a big insurance run in the top of the 7th. Hesse connected on her 2nd run-scoring single to widen the gap 8-5. The Trojans answered when Sidney Magnuson belted a solo homer to center field to start the 7th. But Tigers starter Abby Runyon worked out of trouble, recording her 3rd strikeout to finish her complete game. Quote, "Our players keep finding a way to get it done," Chidester said. "They've really battled and competed well. I'm really proud of their effort. The whole team has stepped up," unquote. In the Metro Roundup, Shea Buskall shutout lifts Cedar Falls past East. And this is a staff report. Cedar Falls. Sophomore Shea Buskall was solid in his first start as Cedar Falls topped Waterloo East 4-0 Thursday in a Metro baseball game at Robinson Dresser Sports Complex. Buskall allowed just 3 hits, struck out 4, and walked none in the complete game effort as the Tigers improved to 9-15 overall. "He competed in the zone all night," Cedar Falls head coach Brett Williams said. "We know we have a good defense, so we challenged him to fill up the zone, and we made some good plays behind him tonight," unquote. The Tigers scored all the runs they would need in the 3rd and a 3-run inning. Ben Phillips went 2-for-4 with an RBI, and Jaden Kramer drove in 2 runs. Cedar Falls also got 2 hits apiece from Brody Bartlett and Gage Francia. Quote, "Justin Thomas does a great job of competing for them," Williams said. Quote, we got a couple big two-out RBIs in that inning. We changed our approach the last couple of weeks to try to limit our strikeouts and making our opponents make plays. We only struck out two times tonight, unquote. The Trojans, 4-25, got hits from Caleb Spooner, Jonah Helmricks, and Brock Kiewit. The two teams play again today at a JVV doubleheader that begins at 3:30 p.m. at East. In the Northwoods League, Harrison Duro pitches Waterloo past Duluth in Northwoods League action, Duluth, Minnesota. Harrison Duro threw six no-hit innings as the Waterloo Bucks scored an 8-5 Northwoods League win over Duluth on Thursday. Duro carried his no-hit bid into the seventh. He finished the night by allowing just two hits and two walks while striking out seven. Duro improved to 2-1 while dropping his earned run average to 186. Waterloo built an 8-0 lead before the Huskers scored five times off three Bucks pitchers in the bottom of the ninth. Bryson Mounts, the third pitcher, got the final out for his second save. Garrett McGowan hammered his third home run of the season while going 2-for-5 with two runs scored and three RBIs. Joshua Kasevich, Daniel Isari, and Sam Biller each had multi-hit games. Biller and Max Young-Goldberg each hit doubles. The Bucks and Huskies play again tonight at 6:30 p.m. in Duluth. Now let's continue reading local news. Despite rains, drought conditions persist in Iowa, filed by Rod Bossart. And the article begins with a photograph taken close-up of soybeans growing during drought conditions. Des Moines. Much of Iowa is facing moderate to severe drought conditions, but timely and beneficial rains have at least stabilized conditions for stressed crops, farmers, and gardeners. The latest U.S. drought monitor issued Thursday shows severe drought for a larger part of the state, 44% versus about 40% last week, in an area covering much of northern and central Iowa. That number stood at 8% at the start of June. More than 90% of the state is abnormally dry, with three-fourths of Iowa in at least moderate drought. A small but growing number of counties in southeast Iowa are reporting normal soil moisture conditions. Quote, generally speaking, much of northern Iowa either stayed the same or got worse in terms of the drought depiction this week, said Curtis Riganti, a climatologist at the National Drought Mitigation Center, who co-authored the latest U.S. Drought Monitor report. Historically, Riganti said, this is one of the most significant droughts we've seen in Iowa in the past century, but it has not been as dry as the 2012-13 period. Iowa will need above-average moisture and below-average temperatures to flip the negative trends that gradually have worsened since the spring planting and summer growing season unfolded. Justin Glisson, a state climatologist, said the past few days of rain were not reflected in the drought report issued Thursday. But the rainfall helped move this June from the driest start in the state history to number 8 on the list, with a statewide average of 1.51 inches, tied with 1956, the 6 days remaining in the month. Quote, we received rainfall right when crops needed it the most, especially after the hot and dry start to June, which is typically the wettest month for the northern two-thirds of the state, Glisson said. Quote, the forecast into the weekend looks excellent for measurable rain through the weekend, he said. But we need forecasts like that through July and August. However, he said, longer-term precipitation deficits on the order of 10 inches to 20 inches go back 6 months to more than a year in the driest parts of Iowa, in the northwest and the west central sections of the state. Quote, as we move forward, we would need to see at least an inch of moisture to hold conditions and the drought monitor map status quo, Glisson said. quote, if we remain in a wet pattern, we could see improvement, though July and August are the hottest months of the year, and thunderstorms have become more variable. Quote, along with maturing crops using more subsoil moisture, conditions could deteriorate during a dry, hot stretch of days, the state climatologist added. In general, we need consistent and, in some places, above-average precipitation over the next several months to put a dent in the longer-term deficits, unquote. The weekly water summary update, issued Thursday by the State Department of Natural Resources, indicated Iowa precipitation totals in June remained 2 inches below normal, with nearly the entire state in some form of dryness or drought. As a result, stream flow is down across the state, and concern remains for shallow groundwater availability, said Tim Hall, DNR's coordinator of hydrology resources. But with rain in the offing, conditions should improve by the next water update on July 10th, he said. A weekly crop report released Monday by the U.S. Department of Agriculture indicated 64% of the state's topsoil moisture level was rated short to very short. It said 69% of subsoil moisture was in that same range, with crops showing signs of stress from the lack of precipitation and high heat. Now, in a story filed by Jeff Reinitz, semi-truck hauling hogs overturns in Waterloo. Towing workers righted a livestock trailer after it overturned Thursday morning. The semi, hauling hogs, rolled onto its side on Donald Street near Logan Avenue. Towing employees used inflatable jacks to get the trailer back on its wheels. The accident happened when the semi was turning onto Donald Street and no other vehicles were involved. No injuries were reported. Driver arrested in Cedar Falls chase and crash. And this story is also filed by Jeff Reinitz. Cedar Falls. A dyke man has been arrested after leading officers on a chase that ended with a crash in Cedar Falls on Tuesday. A Cedar Falls officer attempted to stop a Honda Accord that was heading into town at 90 miles per hour in the 55 mile per hour zone on First Street around 5:45 a.m. The officer attempted to stop the vehicle, but it continued on, crossing into the westbound lanes and weaving in and out of traffic before it crashed in the construction zone in the 1400 block of First Street, according to court records. The driver, 19-year-old Rejun Laniel James, was arrested for eluding, reckless driving, driving without a license, and an unrelated pretrial violation warrant in a stolen check case. In the Metro Briefs column, Button Club meets Wednesday, Waterloo. The Black Hawk Button Club will meet at 1 p.m. Wednesday at St. Paul's United Methodist Church, 207 West Louise Street. Members may now resume selling buttons and button crafts. Following a brief business meeting and in lieu of a formal program, there will be time for members to share their favorite button. For more information, call area code 319-415-9380. Cedar Falls Band to host concert. Cedar Falls. The Cedar Falls Municipal Band, directed by Dennis A. Downs, will present the sixth concert of its Evening Glow Summer Series at 7:30 Tuesday at Overman Park. The Salute to Service program will feature the AMVETS Post 49 Color Guard with a Service Branches medley. The Music Man selections and works by Sousa, Goldman, Osterling, and more. Pre-show jazz will be provided by Checker and Friends. Milestone Band service pins will be presented to Don Rasmussen, Denise Lawrence, Al Copel, Ken Hansi, Sandy McDonald, Mary Smith, Matt Andriani, Kim Mahler, Erica Rath, Marilyn Grady, and Jim Vox. These free outside concerts are presented every Tuesday in June and July. Equity Task Force focuses on policing, education, and housing. Story filed by Amy Rivers and begins with a photograph of Felicia Smith Knowles, Cedar Falls. The city's Racial Equality Task Force will focus on policing, education, and housing, as it sorts through data to figure out what to include in a report this fall. The panel Wednesday divided its 11 members into three subcommittees, tasking with finding data relevant to their topic areas. They will report to the larger group during twice-weekly meetings prior to an October report deadline. The Public Safety Subcommittee will include Paul Lee, Will Frost, and Councilwoman Kelly Dunn. On Education are Felicia Smith-Knowles, LaTanya Graves, Andy Patti, and Councilman Frank Dara. And on Housing are Melissa Heston and Lisa Sesterhan. Members Ishan Valepi and McKay Johnson, both absent during that portion of the meeting, will be added to groups later. Patti, as Cedar Falls Community School District Superintendent, was assigned to lead the Education Committee and gather information. Cedar Falls Police Chief Craig Bertie was assigned the same role with Public Safety. Jennifer Rodenbeck, Director of Finance and Business Operations, said she and City Administrator Ron Gaines would help take the lead on housing. Quote, "We're going to start digging, and we don't know what we're going to find," said Amy Vineyard Weidman, one of two facilitators helping the task force stay focused. Quote, "You're going to be painting a picture you haven't had before and doing some level of meaning-making. We don't know what yet," unquote. Those topics aren't necessarily the only areas the report will address. Smith-Knowles noted data from schools might also be of use to the health or housing departments, for example. Quote, "Oftentimes, we discount the process of preparing the soil," said Smith-Knowles. Quote, "I see this as we're going to dig in the soil and make sure the work we put out there is meaningful," unquote. Dara agreed, saying the soil would be prepared not only for the October report, but years into the future. Quote, "Whatever we end up with, I think, needs to be seen as just the beginning," he said. "We're going to need a group like this for the rest of our lives to keep moving." And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Friday, June 25th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And you may wish to stay tuned to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, which follows shortly. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.